business records, the alleged falsification of which prompted the prosecution against the former president. I vaguely recall hearing that she was one of the people who may be an interesting contestant on the show, Ronograf said when asked whether Stormy Daniels was being considered for a slot on Donald Trump's television program The Apprentice. I can't recall a specific instance where I heard it. It was part of the office chatter. Susan Nashels asked, "You understood that she was there to discuss being cast for The Apprentice, correct?" Graf replied, "I assume that." Nashels then had Graf describe how Donald Trump would occasionally sign checks while he was preoccupied or multitasking. The line of inquiry seemed aimed at establishing that Trump was simply distracted when he signed checks now under prosecutor scrutiny. With David Pecker, defense attorney Emil Bov's questions on cross-examination prompted him to in effect say that coverage beneficial to Donald Trump was business as usual, as the former president's legal team tries to chip away at the prosecution's claim that there was an illicit conspiracy to sway the 2016 presidential race. David Pecker was instrumental in coordinating three hush money payments that were made during the 2016 election campaign to quash negative stories about Donald Trump. In cross-examination, on his fourth day of testimony, David Pecker was grilled by Emil Bov about whether he benefited from running positive stories about Donald Trump and negative stories about other politicians even before the alleged catch-and-kill scheme. Pecker testified that the Enquirer ran negative stories about the Clintons as part of an effort to help Donald Trump's campaign, agreed in a meeting in August of 2015. Asked if there were negative articles before that meeting, David Pecker said, "That's correct," and he agreed that it was because it made good business sense for the National Enquirer to run articles about the Clintons long before he did so on Donald Trump's behalf.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Olympic Games are designed to be the time when global political differences are put aside with the hope that global harmony is every nation's ultimate goal. Unfortunately, the Olympics have long appeared to be under disproportionate Western control, and they have repeatedly politicized the Games to advance their agenda. This year in Paris, Russia and Belarus have been banned from the opening ceremonies, and their athletes who actively support the war in Ukraine are totally banned. If even temporary sports-related harmony is not possible, then many say equality would be the next best thing. That explains the global campaign to ban Israel from the Olympics for their horrific attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing in Gaza.
Right after their invasion, Russia was immediately banned from the Olympics. And yet, after more than half a year of carnage and murder, it is totally unacceptable that we are still asking for just one sanction on Israel. The Olympic Committee is clearly in total complicity with Israel, and we can't accept this in France.
As you just said, it's a double standard. It's a double standard. And besides that, the Olympic game, as I said earlier, is a game about bringing all the nations together with solidarity, peace, and that's not the mood of the genocide. And that's why we ask for the state who's committing genocide to be sanctioned, because that doesn't respect the value of the Olympic Games.
On the rare times when the Olympics are not held in Western nations, mainstream media coverage is almost uniformly negative of the host country. But this time, Western arms and support for the unprecedented bombing and massacre of Gaza appears certain to discredit France and their allies.
I don't know if our leaders will listen to us. They certainly don't have a very good track record of that. But the people of France do not support this genocide, and the Olympic Committee should not either.
It appears certain that many individual athletes and nations will refuse to compete against Israel, even if the Olympic Committee continues to side with Tel Aviv and their war.
There is a non-binding United Nations resolution known as the Olympic Truce, which encourages countries to avoid war during the Games. Many say that if Israel continues its genocidal campaign during the Olympics, it could provoke unprecedented outrage on behalf of long-suffering Palestine. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Students across the country are demanding that their universities and colleges disclose their universities and institutions' ties to the Israeli regime, and, at the same time, divest from them. This has been met with heavy police crackdown, resulting in the arrest of thousands of students, and even including the expulsion of students and them being fired from their jobs. Public colleges and private universities alike are seeing the rise of a new student movement that is more militant and assertive than prior calls for justice.
So we are a generation that says no to these wars, these imperialist interventions into colonialism, and says that we deserve an education that is dedicated to human rights and liberation for all, and that if we don't get it from our elite institutions, we'll build it ourselves.
In the United States, ties to Israel exist at the systematic level. Everything from student exchange programs to institutions being used for technology that will eventually be used by the Israeli regime, including artificial intelligence technology used for surveillance.
We see that the University of Chicago has investments in General Dynamics and Raytheon and Boeing that all fund the bombs that are being dropped on Gazan families. And so we have a responsibility to be here, to camp here and to tell the university to divest.
Brutal tactics are being used by the police, who in the United States also receive training from the Israeli regime specifically on repression to stifle the student movement. Despite the brutal crackdown, students remain adamant and are pursuing their goals towards disclosure and divestment.
The student movement is growing. Now over 80 college campuses have joined the call to disclose and divest from Israel. This means that over 25 states, half of the country, is now seeing mass demonstrations in support for a free Palestine. The state, in turn, has responded with heavy crackdowns, resulting in the arrest of over 1,000 students alone. What remains to be seen is the gains that the student movement gets from this massive movement that is now encompassing the entirety of the United States. Shabir Rizvi reporting from Chicago.
Jubilant supporters of Sayyid Ruhollah Mehdi thronged the streets, waving party flags and chanting slogans as they accompanied their leader to file his nomination for India's general elections. Mehdi, a former lawmaker and a senior member of Kashmir's oldest political party, National Conference, is a popular political figure in the region who is trying his luck from the prestigious Central Kashmir parliamentary seat. For the people of Kashmir, the elections are most significant as the region will vote for the first time after the revocation of Kashmir's special status by India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. In Central Kashmir's parliamentary segment, 29 candidates are in the fray, but the main battle is between two political arch rivals, National Conference and People's Democratic Party. Both the parties are largely fighting the elections for restoration of Kashmir's statehood and semi-autonomy. Ever since New Delhi abolished Kashmir's special status, Mehdi has been strongly opposing the move, calling it undemocratic and unconstitutional.
For this election is being contested to convey the message to Parliament and through Parliament the entire nation of India that the decisions that were taken on August 5, 2019 were taken against the will and the wishes of the people of Kashmir. And all the constitutional norms were violated. We want our dignity to be returned, our democratic rights to be returned, and constitutional status to be restored.
Like Mehdi, his opponent, People's Democratic Party's candidate, and yet another energetic and young political figure, Wahidur Rahman Para, wants people to vote to convey a message to New Delhi that people of Kashmir are not happy.
I think this election is in Kashmir is about hope. People should feel that they are entitled to their rights, so that, you know, whatever has been snatched from us, from our rights to constitution, to democracy, to civil liberties, so that we reclaim that space. The only way to restore everything that we lost is through vote, through electoral participation.
Pertinently, Kashmir has been without an elected government for the last 5 years. Para sees India's general elections as an opportunity to break what he calls the cycle of silence in Kashmir.
Srinagar parliamentary segment has historically witnessed abysmal voter turnout. But with Mehdi and Para in the fray, the political observers believe the contest will be very tight. And this time around, the turnout is expected to be unprecedented. Saidari Safi, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Iran's annual business matching fair underway in Tehran. Over 2,000 investors and business people from 120 countries are making the best of the opportunities provided by the 6th exhibition of Iran's export potentials, also called Iran Expo 2024.
I am grateful for the opportunity to learn more about the Islamic Republic of Iran and the potential for joint business projects. I hope that we can find ways to expand their business and trade relations.
The international event has seen a surge in the number of participants compared to the previous years, as it upholds the slogan of the year, Surge in Production Through People's Participation. And in line with that slogan, Iran's free trade zones are offering investment incentives for foreign venture capitalists and entrepreneurs.
We offer great investment opportunities, and I wouldn't be exaggerating to say that Chabahar is considered a haven for investors, as they are exempt from routine taxation and other customary charges. This will significantly reduce production expenses and the final price, and therefore increases profit. There are also other incentives for foreign investors, which is why I suggest they pay us a visit.
Iran has 6 free trade zones and 16 special economic zones specifically set up to support economic activities and facilitate international trade relations and offer attractive guarantees and protections to foreign investors.
According to the most recent evaluation of free trade zones in Iran, Aras has received the highest score in all categories. We've been able to increase production and sign new investment contracts with foreign businesses, and we are planning to offer even more incentives to those who wish to do business with us.
Iran Expo 2024 is the largest and most important commercial event in the country. It kicked off on April 27th with companies showcasing their latest products and services in different sectors, including industry, agriculture, tourism, and medical equipment.
The week-long event is a great opportunity for investors and business people to familiarize themselves with Iran's potentials in different economic sectors. Isumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
In a resounding display of solidarity, thousands of people congregated near the Pakistani capital Islamabad as the foundation of the Al-Aqsa Museum was ceremoniously laid. This museum is designed to highlight the historical and religious significance of Palestine, aiming to illuminate these facts on a global scale, while also addressing the injustices and hardships faced by Palestinians due to Israeli oppression. The Al-Aqsa Mosque holds deep significance for Muslims worldwide, serving as one of the holiest sites in Islam.
This event basically reflects the need of unity in the Muslim Ummah. That is the uttermost requirement for the Muslim nation. This is the time that Muslims should unite all over the world, irrespective of their small faith differences. And this project here today is reflecting about the need of unity in the entire Muslim Ummah.
People from diverse backgrounds gathered at the site to witness the occasion and express their support for the Palestinian cause.
This is the time that the Palestinian kids, Palestinian people are calling us. And we need to speak out. We need to do something practical for them, because if this time we do not unite, then there will be no other time.
Speakers at the event underscored the urgent need for unity and action to address the plight of oppressed Palestinians during this genocide against them.
Very, very terrible what's happening at the moment, but at the end of the day, I think it comes down to people. Doesn't matter what your background is, or you know where you come from. At the end of the day, people need to be in touch with people. We all need to care. We all need to support each other. And at the end of the day, that's the most important thing.
The event, held amid fervent calls for peace and justice, saw a united front against Israel's ongoing onslaught in the besieged territory.
People here in Pakistan are raising their voices in opposition to the United States and Israel, calling for an end to the latter's genocidal war in Gaza and an immediate ceasefire in the besieged territory. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
Syrians have been living in harsh economic conditions for years due to the post-war circumstances. Prices of essential goods like fuel, medicines, bread, and overall goods supplies have seen a soaring trend because of the Western sanctions and over 13 years of war that terrorists waged upon them. Washington has recently passed new sanctions to increase pressure on Damascus by further crippling vital economic sectors, deepening the crisis and starving the Syrian people.
The U.S. and Western countries need a pretext to continue their economic war after their military invasion to overthrow the Syrian state failed. This new act will certainly affect Syrians, but we will continue to defy the United States, which is also targeting Iran, Russia, China, and other countries. Our defiance will lead to Washington's isolation and international failure.
The Captagon to Act was passed under the pretext of fighting Narcos, oblivious to the fact that the Syrian government was among the initiators of an Arab and regional alliance to combat this issue.
All the pretexts used by the United States in this regard are invalid and legally unsubstantiated. The Syrian government has repeatedly affirmed its readiness to cooperate within a comprehensive international framework to combat the scourge of narcotics and drug trafficking.
The new sanctions leveled against Syria coincide with those imposed on Tehran in the wake of Iran's retaliatory attack on the occupied territories. Some analysts believe these sanctions aim to protect the Israeli regime by distracting the resistance axis countries from their operations in support of Palestine.
This blind Western strategy is also used against countries like Iran and Russia, especially after their military superiority was demonstrated in Ukraine and recently in the Iranian retaliatory strike against a Zionist entity. But these countries have developed ways to overcome the Western sanctions.
The sanctions have embedded the return of displaced Syrians, significantly hindered construction projects in the country, and pushed most Syrians below the poverty line, only due to their commitment to resistance and rejection of normalization with the Israeli regime.
Economic sanctions may serve as a pressure tactic, but they cannot alter the political course, especially when imposed on countries like Syria and Iran, or resistance movements that are ready to make any sacrifices for their causes. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
As the world celebrated 30 years since the end of apartheid in South Africa, protesters assembled in their thousands in London calling for an end to the Israeli apartheid and echoing the global demand for a ceasefire in Gaza.
We are here to call for the victory of the Palestinian struggle, that for us it means the end of this genocidal war against Gaza, against the West Bank for us, and against all the Palestinian people.
It's not in our name. We are selling, England is selling arms to Israel, and it's got to stop. They're creating genocide, and we don't want any part of it.
At the destination of the march in Hyde Park, speaker after speaker, including Northern Ireland's First Minister Michelle O'Neill, called out the American, European and British governments' complicity in the Israeli regime's crimes.
Peace is always possible.
The march came only weeks after the British Prime Minister gave a Downing Street address condemning extremism and saying the protests risked descending into mob rule, and his counter-extremism commissioner claimed London was becoming a no-go zone for Jews on Saturdays. That received pushback from a number of Jewish community leaders and members. And so the tussle between pro-Palestine marchers exercising their freedom of speech and those who want to cancel those marches continue.
The main theme of this protest, as with the previous ones, the killing of so many civilians in the Gaza Strip and the continued UK military and diplomatic support for the Israeli regime. There's also an element of defiance, too, to all the attempts that have been made to disrupt and to antagonize these protests. The protesters here are saying they aren't going anywhere and that they will be coming back again and again as long as the massacre continues. Saeed Purizep, London.
In South Korea Saturday, protesters of U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza marched past the U.S. Embassy and through Seoul's downtown. Abuse and arrests of pro-Palestinian demonstrators at American colleges resonated with South Korean students.
Politicians and the media, in their attempt to justify such a crackdown, slander the Palestinian Solidarity Movement as spreading anti-Semitism. But history will remember them as accomplices in genocide.
This is the 32nd rally of South Korea's people in solidarity with Palestine, protesting against Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. As more and more reports surface outlining Israeli atrocities there, concern here grows over the situation in Rafah and Israel's increasing attacks against civilians there.
Participants call for a stoppage to Israel's imminent ground invasion of Rafah. At Seoul National University, a professor is under investigation for defacing a pro-Palestine poster after harassing a student. Such pressure tactics are seen by some demonstrators as an opportunity to set the record straight.
The professor, who's a Zionist, obviously, is trying to silence our voices about speaking up about against the genocide that is happening in Gaza and the occupation of Palestine. But at the same time, I feel like this is a chance for us to raise more awareness about what is happening and about why Zionism is, why Zionism is bad.
Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the United States became even more isolated, vetoing the April 18th resolution to extend full membership to Palestine, with several U.S. allies, including South Korea, voting in favor. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The Supreme Leader's View of Palestine, The History of Occupation, How Palestine Was Occupied. Through a historical process consisting of tens of initiatives by the enemy, Palestine became a Zionist property. A number of globally influential Jews started to think of establishing an independent state for Jews. Of course, they initially thought of going to Uganda and establishing their nation there. For some time, they also thought of going to Tripoli, the capital city of Libya. Then they talked to Italians who were then ruling Tripoli. But Italians rejected their request. Finally, they made a deal with the English. The English had very important colonialist ambitions for the Middle East at that time. They realized that the settlement of the Jews in the Middle East was in their best interest.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The English only wanted to solve their own problems. The occupation of Palestinian lands was based on a multilateral, complex plan which had been designed to prevent Muslim unity and the re-establishment of powerful Muslim governments. There is some evidence that shows the Zionists had close relations with the Nazis, and the exaggerated figures about the number of Jews massacred was itself used as a tool to attract global sympathy and prepare the ground for occupying Palestine and justifying the crimes committed by the Zionists. There's even some evidence to suggest that some non-Jewish thugs from East Europe were sent to Palestine as Jews in order to establish an anti-Islamic government at the heart of the world of Islam, using the support for surviving victims of racism as a cover. They wanted to create a chasm between the Western and Eastern part of the Muslim world. In the beginning, Muslims were taken by surprise because they were not aware of the nature of the Zionists and their Western supporters' plan. The Ottoman Empire was defeated. The victors of the World War signed the Sykes-Picot Agreement in secret to carve up the Muslim countries of the Middle East region between themselves. The international community gave Palestine's custody to the English, who promised to help the Zionists. The English brought Jews to Palestine with a set of well-thought-out plans and displaced Muslims from their homes.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, there is a possibility that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and other members of his cabinet may be issued arrest warrants by the ICC very soon. We're going to take a look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Ontario, Robert Fatina, author and journalist. And out of Norway, John Stepling, author and commentator. Welcome both of you to the program. I'd like to start it off with Robert. I mean, why is it that neither the U.S. nor the Zionist regime, neither one of them is a part of the ICC's Rome Statute?
This is because they have no respect or regard for international law. They want to be able to commit crimes in violation of international law, crimes against humanity at will, in order to expand their empire, their empires, and therefore they have not recognized the ICC. They do not want to be obligated to adhere to any rules, any rules of conduct that are established internationally, so that they can go about doing the kind of destruction that we're seeing on the screen right now, the destruction of Gaza, which Israel is perpetrating with complete U.S. financing and diplomatic cover. So these are two rogue nations. The United States is very powerful, and it lends its power to Israel, which are not part of, not really part of the global community in the sense that they have respect for the community and want to be reasonable members of it.
Well, John, is it that neither regime has a problem with committing any of those four major international crimes that were mentioned?
No, they have a long record of committing war crimes. The ICC has no mechanism by which it can arrest or apprehend anybody. So this is largely a symbolic statement. There's something like 20 warrants standing, outstanding warrants that the people named have ignored over the last 15 years. Israel, if they issue one for Netanyahu, they will ignore it also. They've already said they're going to ignore it. They've already said they don't recognize the court. And admittedly, this is a pretty politicized court anyway. They issued a warrant for Putin. So this is more to be read as a kind of political barometer for the changes in opinion. There are protests at just countless universities in the United States, highly organized protests that won't go away. These things have an effect. Public opinion has been overwhelmingly against Israel globally, even in the United States. And most tellingly, perhaps, last week, Naomi Klein wrote an op-ed at The Guardian, which is the mouthpiece for the liberal establishment, and the title was Zionism Must End. This right. was a kind of remarkable occurrence. We had not seen anything like that, but I suspect this is part of a damage control, in a sense, from the United States. They recognize Biden is way behind in the polls. They need to do something to win back voters to the Democratic Party, who are seen to be party to the genocide Israel is committing. Everybody knows in the whole world that Israel is committing war crimes, committing genocide. This is hardly a secret. It's the most documented and filmed genocide in history. So, you know, what all the moving parts are in this sort of management of optics remains to be seen. But it's not completely insignificant. Certainly, it says the United States and Israel are becoming pariahs globally.
Well, Robert, your perspective, we've just heard what John thought basically about the ICC's arrest warrants, but in your perspective, does it carry any weight at all? For example, if an arrest warrant is issued for Netanyahu, would it be affected? Would the regime be affected in any way?
It will be in some ways. Of course, once an arrest warrant is issued, any country that has signed on to the ICC, and it's over 140 countries, is obligated under law to arrest anybody who sets foot in their country who has an arrest warrant. Now, whether or not this will be done remains to be seen, but it will pressure Netanyahu and those others who may be issued warrants. It may curtail their travel. It will certainly put a damper on their ability to globe trot around the world trying to seek additional support for their criminal regime. Now, if they do get arrested in some country, then that would be unprecedented. It would be a really wonderful thing to see. It would give the ICC a lot more credibility than it has currently. But that's something that we have to see. The arrest warrants haven't been issued yet. But there are reports that Netanyahu is very concerned about this. And that in itself is something.
Well, I mean, as John said, optics are everything. And even that, perhaps, with it even being talked about, the possibility of that warrant being issued, perhaps it's problematic for Netanyahu. But, John, your perspective in general, I mean, what does this say about Washington? Because we have reports now that even right now the U.S. is trying its best not to allow this arrest warrant to be issued by the ICC. I mean, what kind of message? Because you talked about optics. So let's look at that. What kind of message is that actually sending to, if you want to say, the Democratic voters or to the other Americans or to the world? I mean, is it that Palestinian lives are does not matter as much? I mean, what is it that they're what is it that they're saying?
Yeah, it's a good question in a sense, but it's the same question I would apply to this op-ed by Naomi Klein. This is somebody who is, you know, in bed with the Rockefeller Foundation. She's a part of the World Economic Forum. She's, you know, an establishment figure. And she writes this op-ed saying Zionism must end. She does not say, however, that there needs to be a Palestinian state, that Palestine has endured a 75-year brutal occupation. No, history is kind of erased. She even implies that the the current genocide is to be laid at the feet of Donald Trump and Jared Kushner. It's very strange in that sense. Mm-hmm. But this is because there the protests and opinion, and there's more and more people of influence and celebrity who are coming out against Israel. And this, I think, for the people that spin these things mm-hmm. in Washington mm-hmm. and Tel Aviv, this is very troubling. And your other guest is right to the extent that, you know, this will put a damper on certain fundraising enterprises, certainly. No country that I can think of is going to arrest Netanyahu if he travels there, though. And this is the problem with the ICC. As I said, there's numerous outstanding warrants that have been outstanding for over a decade, and nobody does anything about it. And those figures travel all over the world. They don't publicize it, but they do. So, I mean, this is a symbolic event at best, but it does speak to the fact that, you know, global opinion is just like overwhelmingly. On the side of the Palestinians. I think people have awoken, people that previously didn't understand the occupation, they have awoken to the reality. You can't You can't see the carnage that you see on social media, you know, all the platforms, and not be affected by it. People are horrified. And so, you know, one does wonder when op-eds like that occur in an establishment paper like The Guardian, what is really going on? Is Netanyahu really being thrown under the bus, or is this a part of a more elaborate scripting of things to... Mm-hmm. to sort of absolve the United States for their part in it and replace Netanyahu with somebody else that will put a more moderate face on the occupation, which is what I suspect will happen.
Well, what about that, Robert? I mean, when we look at the establishment, as John was talking about, and, for example, the article by Naomi Klein, I mean, is it indicative, perhaps, of the fear, of the anxiety that the powers that be have right now inside of the United States? When we look at these student protests that's growing day by day, and these kids, they do have a lot to lose. Some of them have been suspended, some have been expelled, arrested, so many things can affect their future, of course, over there. But they don't care because, as John has said, I mean, watching this carnage almost 7 months now, they just couldn't handle it anymore. So let's talk about the establishment and that possibility, that fear factor, because if this Gen Z really uniting in the way that it appears that they are on the issue of Palestine, it could be quite dangerous for the U.S. regime. Your thoughts?
Yes, it could be, because the U.S. has been the main supporter of Israel for decades, gives Israel more aid than it gives to all the other countries it gives foreign aid to combined. It has protected Israel diplomatically from any accountability for its many war crimes and crimes against humanity. But we are, as Mr. Stepling said, seeing a major change now. The support for the Palestinians is overwhelming around the world. We see that even in some news media. We're seeing many, many more pro-Palestine articles and news articles about Palestine than we've seen in the past. Palestine is not being viewed on many so-called mainstream media outlets as the villain, as the perpetrator, and Israel is not being seen as an innocent victim. This is a major change when previously the Palestinians were always seen as the enemy, as terrorists, and Israel was simply, quote, trying to defend itself. We see now that is not the case. Some of us have known it for a long time. But between social media, which is what the Gen Z generation uses to connect with each other and to learn about what's going on in the world, through social media, the rest of the world is seeing the horrors, the deaths of innocent men, women, children, the slaughters, the starvations. They're seeing this. And so the United States is supporting it all. And people are beginning to say that this is wrong, as we see in the university campus demonstrations, which, as you mentioned, are growing every day. They're huge, they're strong, they're powerful, and the demonstrators are taking risks, yet they are opposing the U.S. imperial and colonial ventures in the Middle East. And they're doing this out of conscience and because it's the right thing to do. So it is a change, and it has the potential to impact U.S. governance.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, John, Robert talked about the change in some of the mainstream media. But I want to look at an incident that happened actually yesterday that it was a correspondence dinner for some of these journalists in Washington, D.C. And then we saw protests actually outside of that venue. And basically people were saying shame, 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 because these mainstream journalists had barely talked about the situation that's been taking place for almost 7 months now. And it was very interesting to see these so-called journalists walking through the protests and not even looking left or right as people were shouting different things, especially as a journalist. It should show some type of perhaps empathy and curiosity. But do you think during this 6-7 months of this genocide, not only has the American and Israeli regimes been exposed, but also entities such as the media, mainstream media, been exposed more than ever during this time?
I think that's absolutely true. And that may be the most significant takeaway from this. I think more people, especially young people who were previously, you know, uninformed and trusted the establishment legacy media outlets for their knowledge of the world, they are suddenly recognizing that they have been lied to profoundly. And in a sense, there's echoes of the Vietnam War protests in all of this too. Now, there are contradictions, and this is what I find fascinating, because the police have brutally suppressed a lot of these protests on university campuses. And Israel is scrambling to put a correct spin on the whole thing. Ben Gavir said, we will send armed IDF soldiers to protect Jewish students at these universities. Nobody buys this. Nobody buys this. And you know, everyone knows Jewish students are not under any threat. The students have learned enough to understand what Zionism is, that this is a colonial occupation, and it's been funded and protected and enabled by the United States for over 75 years, and that the Palestinians have been subjected to just almost incomprehensible cruelty and deprivation for all of that 75 years. And so people are waking up to this, and the young especially, and yes, they see that these establishment journalists have been lying. And I have seen, you know, talk shows and interviews with the sort of pro-Israeli journalists being attacked, being asked very hard questions, and being exposed as dishonest and culpable in their distortions about this genocide. And that's something new. I've not seen that before, and it's significant, I think. So yeah, that's a big part of this, where that goes and how long the U.S. can continue to sort of speak out of both sides of its mouth, because the protests aren't going away. People understand what is happening largely, even if they're not politically mature or knowledgeable. They understand this is a genocide, that people are starving every minute. Children are dying. Children are starving. That the settler mentality is insane, fanatical. They were cheering the blockage of food into Gaza to feed starving children. This is not lost on the protesters. They understand what is happening, and I think many, many people are truly shocked by it. Others, like us, are not shocked. We expect this from the U.S. But for many, this is a new truth that is being,
Well, let's look at that, Robert, the new truth that John just talked about, because we're looking at, for example, there were many people who, as he said, this has been their first exposure to a lot of this. And not only have, for example, some of these kids, they have seen the way that the police have cracked down on them, on academics, They have seen their country that says it believes in democracy, protection, the rights of women, the rights of kids, and all of that totally ignore that when it comes to Palestine. So I want to look at this is even beyond what is happening in Gaza, beyond the Palestinian situation. Do you think this is basically, we can say, an aha moment that will change the future and the direction? I mean, your assessment of what seems to be a major transition that's taking place.
Yes, these young students are going to be elected officials eventually, many of them. They're going to become lawyers, and they're going to be in positions of authority in the United States. And they are learning today some very valuable lessons about the hypocrisy of the United States government currently, about the fact that the news media is controlled by the government and that it just simply echoes U.S. government talking points without doing the real journalistic work of finding out what's really happening, finding out the causes and the impacts of various activities. One of them, of course, being the resistance of October 7th, when that wasn't the start of this. That started in 1948. We know that. But many of these young people are only now discovering that, and they're horrified at what they're seeing and what they're learning and at what how the United States government has lied to them through their government officials and through the corporate-owned media. So they're seeing this, and they're not going to forget. They're not going to forget these horrific scenes that are coming out of Gaza and knowing that the United States has supported. They're not going to forget that the United States did not force Israel to provide humanitarian aid and instead enabled the Israeli regime to starve children to death. And there are the pictures that we're seeing coming out of Gaza from social media, not from the news, the legacy media, but from social media, will haunt many of us to our dying day. And this is going to impact these young students. They're not going to forget. And when they are in positions of authority, they are going to act accordingly.
I'm so sorry we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Robert Fatina, author and journalist out of Kitchener, Ontario. John Sepling, author and commentator out of Inderøy, Norway. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.